All right, I'd like to call to order this meeting of the Alaska State Legislators, Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. Today is July 22nd, 2015. We are meeting in the Anchorage LIO Auditorium. It is just shortly after 9:30 in the morning. Like, first make sure that we have our secretary online in Juneau. Madam Secretary, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Madam Secretary. Madam Secretary, are you online?
Yes, can you hear me?
And we will take an at ease while we figure out what's wrong. Madam Secretary, could you please call the roll of the committee?
Representative Keto?
Here.
Representative Olson?
Online.
Representative Thompson?
Present.
Representative Pruitt?
Here.
Representative Newman? Senator Stedman? Senator Bishop? Senator Giesel?
Here.
Senator Hoffman?
Here.
Senator Kelly?
Here.
Senator McKinnon, Vice Chair?
Here.
Chair Hawker?
I'm present. This does provide us with a quorum without our alternate, but our alternate, Senator Kelly, you are certainly more than welcome to join us here up front if you want, but by the operations of Alaska State Statute 24.20.165, the alternate members only vote if it's necessary to provide a quorum. But you are very welcome to join us, sir. Very happy to have you here. This meeting has been scheduled. Our primary agenda item is the presentation and release of the K-12 education study that was engaged with Augenblick, Palish and Associates, and very much appreciate their work. We also had intended at this meeting to present the results of the proposal evaluation committee for selecting a Medicaid consultant for the Alaska State Legislature. I want to emphasize to folks that is a very different agenda item than taking up anything related to the governor's executive order in determining that he will unilaterally accept additional Medicaid funding. But as this is played, and we are not taking up, as we did notice on our noticing system, that we will not be taking up the governor's RPLs or any request at this meeting regarding his decision to implement expanded Medicaid. As to the reform and expansion consulting procurement, we were going to be presenting the results of a proposal evaluation committee today. But at the very last hour, I have received note that in our final legal review of the process that was undertaken and the qualification of the proposers, that our lawyers have asked for additional time to consider a couple of matters that may have affected the outcome of that proposal evaluation committee. It has nothing to do with the operation of the committee or the legislature, anyone involved. It's some legal interpretations they want to be sure they've got straightened away before we continue and award a consulting contract. So that item three, will be removed from the agenda today, taken up at a later meeting. What it does get us to is much quicker than you thought you were going to be on the deck. I would like to invite everyone to join us at the front table here. These are our representatives from Augenblick, Palish and Associates, APA. These folks have been working diligently since back during legislative session to interview our school districts, review and work with Alaska's our state funding program. Their mission was to evaluate how our state funding mechanism works in relation in the state of Alaska, how we might make it better, and things that we might want to consider in regards to how other states approach the same issues that we all face, and that's providing an appropriate level of funding and the mechanisms in which we do it for our students. And our folks here today have a the final report is available to everyone. It's the lengthy document that's on the tables at the back of the room. There's also, at the front of that document, is an executive summary, but today I'll turn it over to our consultants to present this to us. They do have a PowerPoint to kind of guide us through their key points, and with your permission as we get going in this, you know, I would, you know, ask that would you be willing to take questions from the committee as you go through your presentation?
We would be willing to do that.
Excellent. And actually, as I before we begin this, I would note for the record that we have Representative Edgman online, and as we start our education process here, we have, let's see, we've got Representative Tarr in the room, we've got Representative Vasquez, Representative Reinbold. I see no other representatives or senators. Oh, Rep. Johnson, are you hiding back there? Hey, you're hiding back there. Rep. Johnson, welcome. Good to have you here. But with that, I'll turn the education presentation over to our good folks at APA.
Thank you, Chairman. Justin Silverstein with Augenblick Pelletier & Associates. We try to go by APA Consulting so that people can say our name. So APA is just the way to go. I have with me Amanda Brown from our firm. The two of us really led this project for the year, but we had about 6 to 8 other members of our staff working on this project at any one time over the past couple months. And so the work you see is really a collaboration with a number of different people at our shop in Denver. So just quickly, who is APA? We are a Denver-based education policy consulting firm. We were founded in 1983. We have worked in all 50 states around looking at school finance issues. And that includes looking at the structure of different state systems across the country and helping design state systems in places like Louisiana, Maryland, and Mississippi. And so we have a broad range of knowledge around school finance and what's going on across the country, how different states address different sets of student and district needs. And we brought that to the table. Today we're going to split up our presentation. Amanda's actually going to take the front end of the presentation and really talk about what did we do, what were the different study approaches that we undertook to examine Alaska's school finance structure. And then I'm going to go ahead and walk through the recommendations we're making. And so you're going to get about 45 slides to talk about 135-page report that has obviously a lot more detail than we're going to be able to dive into. Mm-hmm. But we're going to really try to hit those highlights and what we are finding. As we get started, I first want to thank the committee and the legislature, the legislative staff, DED, and really the school districts around the state. We talked to a lot of people. We spent a lot of time with different people across the state and a lot of school districts, and without their help, we really couldn't have done this work. And so we just want to make sure we put that thank you out there as we get started.
And I thank you. And as you get ready to get started, any questions from the committee at this time for our consultants to set the table here? Hearing, see none, please. If you introduce yourself for the record, and again, you know, in that we've got folks that do monitor this online, if you could, you know, kind of when you guys go back and forth, just reintroduce yourselves so they know who's speaking.
Amanda Brown with APA. So I want to walk through first, what is today's presentation going to look like? It's a little different than what we have in the report. As Justin mentioned, it's quite a long and detailed report, so we're going to do our best to provide as much of, distill as much of the information as possible in a relatively manageable presentation. So we're going to start with both an overview of what was the study, what it includes through the RFP, what we were tasked to do. Then each of the tasks we undertook. We'll walk through the interviews we did with district leaders, the review we took of each of the funding components in the current system, two sets of data analysis that we did, both an equity study, and then a study that looked at the relationships between performance, student need, and expenditures. We also looked at the fiscal sustainability and revenue sources for education. And then, as Justin mentioned, he'll take over looking at the recommendations. So going to the next slide. So through the RFP, we were tasked with conducting what we would call kind of a structural review of the current system. meaning we weren't asked to really think about what should be the total dollars available, what would be adequate to ensure that all students could be successful, or to determine if specific adjustments within the formula were correct. So, for example, we were tasked with looking at, does it make sense to have a district cost factor in your current system to account for cost differences between places based on their location? But we weren't asked to determine what the specific adjustment should be. So not, does it make sense that it's 1.0 for this district and 1.5 here, but more, should it be part of the current funding system? And we did want to note that we know that there's a current lawsuit, the Ketchikan lawsuit, looking at the constitutionality of having a local contribution requirement, but we were really tasked with looking at the current system and the current governance structure, so that's outside of our work, so we won't be commenting on that.
You know, you might point that microphone a little bit more towards yourself. You've got a quiet voice, and
sorry.
I can tell it's a little hard for people in the back of the room to hear, so if I could just
and
ask for
let me know if you can.
A little projection, please.
Perfect. I will project more. So the next slide is really thinking through what are some objectives that you can consider when looking at any formula within a state. So our objectives would be the idea that, based on our experience, a strong education funding system is one that is equitable. It is one that is responsive to the needs of students and to schools and districts, one that is both adequate and efficient in the resources it provides, and one that is also flexible, giving local control to districts to determine how best to use resources. We believe these objectives are a reasonable starting point for examining any state system. And I'll note that one of our key tenets is really around adequacy, but again, that wasn't a part of this study, so we won't be commenting on it in our work today. Okay, so what did we do? We undertook this study from late February through July, and we included both reviewing the current structure, and that included speaking with several folks to really understand how does it operate today, conducting interviews with district stakeholders to understand how the current school funding structure affects individual districts, examining other states' approaches to school funding, examining the equity of the current system, looking both at kind of school and district equity and taxpayer equity as well. As I said, analyzing the relationships between performance, expenditures, and student need, examining state sources of revenue, and developing the recommendations. So the first tasks that we undertook were the interviews. And we tried to provide the opportunity for district leaders from every district in the state to participate through one avenue or another. First, there was an open public listening session where we just took feedback at the onset of the study. We conducted some group phone interviews. We did about 5 of those, breaking districts into certain categories, such as rural, urban, distant, single-site school districts. And then we did a series of in-person individual interviews. We had 2 teams that were out in Alaska. We were able to speak with 11 districts on site at that time. And then we did some individual follow-up districts by phone for some districts that we wanted to spend some more time with, but that the schedule didn't allow us to come out to them, or that after we did the interviews, we felt like we had a gap in that area. In all, we had leaders from 31 school districts participate through one of those processes. We didn't keep attendance records of that kind of open public session, so that is not inclusive of folks that participated in that one. We also interviewed other stakeholders, including DEED staff. And our focus with all of these interviews was to gain a better understanding of how does the current system work, how is it impacting districts, and what is the unique Alaska context that we need to consider as we evaluate the system. So just some general themes from the interviews. Justin is going to provide a lot more detail on what we were hearing for each of the specific components when he talks about the recommendations. But in general themes, we found that districts were generally happy with the current funding system and believed it included the right components for funding. There was strong concern about any changes in the current revenue environment would be a zero-sum game, meaning if there's not any new additional dollars available, that to give additional dollars to one district would necessarily take it from another. So there was concerns about any of movement between districts. And interviews understood that Alaska has some complexity and some challenges in funding across the state, and they thought that the system was doing a good job really thinking through that complexity. the next slide talking about our review of the funding system. So again, we examined each of the components within the system through interviews, comparing it to other states and analyzing relevant data, and we'll discuss those results in more detail in the recommendation. So the first task was really understanding what does the current funding program look like. And under the current foundation formula, a district's basic need, or that total amount of money that should be in place, is determined by taking a base student allocation by a district's average daily membership. And that figure is calculated through a series of adjustments, first taking a district's average daily membership, adjusting that by the size of schools within it, and there's some differences based on the size of the community and certain cut points that are within that. Adjusting it by the district cost factor, which again is accounting for differences based on the location and remoteness of a district. They can range from 1.0 in Anchorage up to over 2 in other locations. There's also a special needs factor that is an additional 20% to account for 4 categories of students. That's your vocational education or career and technical, CTE. There is also non-intensive special education, bilingual, bicultural, and gifted and talented. That's within what we would call kind of a block funding for that. And then finally, there's also a vocational technical CTE adjustment at 1.5%. And what's unique is that each of the adjustments in that first line is multiplied against the preceding. So you take the original average daily membership adjusted by size, you multiply that against the district's cost factor, which is then multiplied against its special needs factor and the vocational factor. There are 2 additional student counts that are then added on top of that total that's created in that front line, which are your intensive student service count, so your intensive special education, each of those students, instead of being counted as 1, is counted as 13, so a weight of 13. And then you add on top of that your correspondent student count, which is counting every student as 0.9 of a student for the purposes of funding. And that grand total gives you the datum, the district average daily membership, which is multiplied by your base students to get to your total basic need. Separate from that funding formula is then the funding for transportation and for capital. So the first of our data analysis that we did was looking really at the equity of the system. We looked at the demographics, wealth information, revenues, and expenditures of districts. All that data was provided by DED. And we focused on really, there's 3 areas of equity that you can consider. First is horizontal equity, which is how similarly are similar places funded compared to each other. Vertical equity looks at how well the system takes into account varying student need. And then fiscal neutrality assesses the link between local wealth and the amount of revenue available to support a school district. So that's kind of where that taxpayer piece will fit into that. In Alaska, it can be challenging to consider the equity of the current system, both because there's extreme variation in the size, the location, and remoteness of your districts, as well as there are significant adjustments in the current system to account for those differences. And the final piece is often you look at equity with a lens of property wealth, which, as we know, is not included in all districts here. Only your city and borough districts have local wealth. So we had to create a wealth proxy that took into account impact data available. So we could kind of do a bit more of an apples-to-apples comparison and include all districts in the state in our analysis. And we also used some weighted student counts to account for student need differences and those differences due to size and location that your current system is picking up. So as best we could to get every district on an even playing field to compare against each other, if that makes sense. Okay. So when we think about horizontal equity, we found that there was a high level of variation when examining horizontal equity across the state, meaning that different districts are funded differently in the state, which is not unusual given the different circumstances they are in. You would expect to really see that there is differences there. A little stats term that we often use is the coefficient of variation, which measures the difference and variation that you see between places. And generally, an accepted coefficient of variation would be below 0.10. And like we said, we saw variations that were more around the 0.4 range or 0.32. And we both looked at kind of total expenditures and then dove deeper into just looking at instructional expenditures. When we thought about the vertical equity of the system, So knowing that we saw differences in how expenditures were across different districts, we wanted to see how much of that could be accounted for by the different needs of students in the district or the different size or location. So that's where those weighted figures started to come into play. We still found that once we accounted for student need, there was still high levels of variation. They were reduced from what we saw when we didn't consider that, but they were still higher than what would be a generally acceptable standard for either total or instructional expenditures. And finally, thinking through the fiscal neutrality, there's a common benchmark in this area. You would want to see a 0.50 correlation, meaning the relationship between wealth, or in this case the wealth proxy, and how much money is available locally. So current system is below that metric, so that tells us that it's generally meeting that kind of fiscal neutrality standard when you consider the relationship between wealth and spending. So our next analysis is really trying to understand that relationship between student performance, expenditures, and student need. So we first...
Actually, before you go on to that slide, I just, you know, interject with you here. You're giving us a very high-level abstract of the report, and within the detailed report analysis itself is a very detailed, excruciatingly detailed statistical analysis that supports and explains the equality positions you were just discussing here at a very, very, as it strikes me as you're speaking, it's such an incredibly high level. The report goes into it in just infinite detail.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it does go into quite a bit more detail. I'm trying to give you what were the key pieces to take away from that, but I hope everyone will take the opportunity to read through the report and really get that full understanding that we've included there.
Thank you. Please continue.
So looking at those relationships, the first thing we considered was the relationship between student need, so the demographics of a school or district, how many students have language issues, Alaska Native students, your special education students, and performance. Using linear regression, which we explain in more detail in the report, we tried to determine if there was a relationship between the two. And what we found is there's a significant relationship between the demographics of schools and districts and their ultimate performance on Alaska's student-based assessment. The three demographic variables that had this relationship were students with disabilities or special education students, LEP, which is limited English proficiency, also it could be English language learners, that category of students, and Alaska Native students. So what this means that for as the percentage of students in these population groups increased within the district, their performance on the SBA decreased. So it was a negative relationship between the two. And our analysis also found that there was a high degree of variation in the percentages of students in those categories between districts.
Madam Vice Chair.
Could you restate the, I don't know if I got this right, but please clarify that if more money or resources went to the area, they were receiving negative results? Is that what you just said?
So through the chair, what this means is we weren't quite yet looking at the expenditures that were associated. All we were saying is really the relationship between the demographics existed and the performance. So just when you had a higher number of students in those categories, performance decreased. So in the next area, we'll really talk what does that mean at the expenditure level. Thank you. So great lead-in. The relationship between performance and expenditures was the next thing we looked at. So we did a regression analysis examining the relationship between proficiency levels and then two categories, both total expenditures and then just instructional, knowing that total includes quite a few operational expenses that are not necessarily related to instruction, might not have an impact.
And could you clarify for the committee how you determined what were instructional expenditures?
That's great. The instructional expenditures were a reporting line out of DEED's data. It's the instructional services category of expenses. What we found was that higher instructional expenditures do show a statistically significant positive relationship with performance. So to the earlier question, if more resources were put in place, you were seeing outcomes for student achievement. We did not see a relationship between total expenditures and performance, And as I said, that total figure includes a lot of operational expenditures. So it's not unusual that that would not be related to student achievement. Just one second. Not clicking. There we go. Okay. So the last step in our analysis here was to examine the relationship between student need and the current adjustments in the funding system. So to do that, as I mentioned, there was a series of adjustments that are all multiplied against each other. So the district cost factor is related to the size adjustment, which is related to the special needs. So even though the special needs adjustment is 20% for all districts, because it's multiplied against their size and district cost factor, really they do have different weights once you add those together, what we call an imputed weight. So if you took the number of additional ADM that's generated after the special needs divided by the original ADM, you find that each district has a unique adjustment. So in one district, for example, that had a size adjustment factor equivalent to a 1.10, knowing each school is actually adjusted independently, a district cost factor of 1.44, you would end up with an imputed special needs adjustment of about 32%. In a different district that has a higher size adjustment of 1.2 and a higher district cost factor of 1.8, they would really end up with a 43% adjustment for special needs due to that multiplying nature of the first set of adjustments in the formula.
Senator Fairclough, or excuse me, Senator McKinnon, my apologies again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm intrigued by the issue of the operating expense versus instructional expense, and I have two questions.
Yeah.
The first question is, in the review that you've done so far, related to the three items, English as a second language, Alaska Native population, do you see a higher investment in operating expense dollars versus instructional expense dollars as far as a ratio goes against other districts?
So this is Justin Silverstein, Chairman. We did not look at that specific lens. So what this was really was a regression analysis looking at two data points on expenditure and then those data points being regressed against characteristics of the districts and trying to figure and examining which of those variables, the demographic variables, showed statistically significant impacts on the student performance. So we didn't get down to that level of detail. It would also be very difficult, at least in the data we have, to know expenditures related to certain populations, because I think, as you know, that's not part of the funding system. They're not reporting back that says this is what we spent on LEP versus special ed, most likely you do have, but LEP versus, let's say, your Alaska Native populations. We wouldn't be able to tease out that level of expenditure detail to then regress against this information. And so that's where we are.
Mr. Chairman, let me...
Mr. McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To clarify, I'm wondering about the operating expense, not the instructional dollars. So the operating expense of a facility is not variable. They should be fixed numbers, and if you pull out the instruction, I don't know if it's as simple as that, you would come up with an operating for a particular item. And where I'm driving to is if there's fixed costs and other communities aren't able to invest in instruction, I'm wondering if it has an impact on the overall system, because we've had that conversation at this committee and others, whether we should look at fixed costs. So my follow-up question then at looking at fixed costs and how they're different by district, depending on what's happening, is whether you considered under those fixed cost expenses of your overall spend for a district, the additional one-time money that we've provided for at least 6, if not 10 years, under the leadership of Chairman Hawker and others, energy cost equalization, basically. We were trying to provide one-time funding for those districts. And so that's why I posed the question, if in fact the instructional dollar going into the classroom has a benefit for the students in our population, but the challenge for the district is their fixed costs, it's important for us to know that. And the Senate did have, under the leadership of Senator Dunleavy, quite extensive conversations about those fixed costs. That's why I'm asking, Mr. Chairman. So if you don't have it, I understand, mm-hmm. but if you can respond, I'd appreciate it.
So when we, Mr. Chairman, when we get to the recommendations, we'll mention that in the interviews and in talking to districts, that point was highlighted frequently, which is as operating expenditures become a higher percent of total expenditures, that can really drive dollars away from instruction. And so that is a question that districts have, especially for districts who are declining in enrollment, but their fixed structures are of a similar size. So that came up. We did not do a data analysis on that that question that you have.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. So, Amanda Brown, again. So what we wanted to do, as I talked about, we came up with what are those imputed weights, knowing that different districts receive different percentage adjustments for special needs based on both their size and their district location because of that multiplying a factor. So we wanted to see if the imputed weights were correlated with student needs in districts. So if the way the current funding system works is already accounting for the variance in student need because these weights vary from place to place. But what we found was that there was not a high correlation between the two, meaning the current difference in imputed weights does not add, does not account for the difference in student need between places. So the last area I have to talk about, and again, everyone, thanks for bearing with me on what's trying to give you a very high level of some very statistically detailed information. So the last area is fiscal sustainability. I'm on the wrong. Sorry, one quick second. So none of this information will probably be very surprising to everyone. So we might be stating things that are commonly obvious, so forgive us for that. First thing is that Alaska has a high reliance on oil revenues, which can be an issue with falling oil revenues for sustainability. Alaska is one of only 7 states that doesn't have an income tax and only 5 states that have no state sales tax. When we compared it against other states, we found that even other states that were more reliant on oil revenues still typically had either a state sales tax or an income tax to fall back on. Alaska had the highest percentage reliability on those funding sources. And what we found is that 83% of Alaska's revenues, and I should pause, all this information came from the U.S. Census Bureau because we wanted to be able to do a comparison against other states, so it's not Alaska-specific information. But about 83% are in what's called other tax category, which would be your oil taxes. About another 12% are either in corporate income or property tax, but what we know is the majority of those taxes are still being levied on oil and gas companies. So what that means is just a very high percentage of your incoming tax revenue is on oil and gas. Again, probably no surprise to anyone in the room. What we also looked at was that Alaska is relatively wealthy in terms of annual personal income, so a little bit higher than the national average, but it is among the lowest in local taxes as well. We also did a look at how stable are Alaska's current revenue streams over a period of time. So we looked at between 2005 and 2012. We found that Alaska's revenues have been more volatile than the national average. We did also find that there's two potential sources of revenue that could help stabilize until additional revenue sources were available if the state considered kind of diversifying its revenue streams. And Justin will really dive into this when we get into the recommendation section.
Okay.
Now we get to the meat of the presentation.
Absolutely. So, Justin Silverstein, and I'm going to start walking through the recommendations, and as Amanda mentioned earlier, and I want to bring that back up, we're going to try to incorporate also that information from the interviews, what we learned from other states, and any sort of other data analysis as we talk about the recommendations. When you see the report, that's its own section, but we thought to talk about all that and then come back to it, a little bit, one, redundant, and it would just create a little bit of contextual issue in this type of presentation. So we're going to try to do both. But there's, again, a lot of detail and a lot of areas in the report, and we'll try to hit those highlights. So the first thing just to keep in mind is that the intent for the recommendations is to strengthen the current formula and to ensure that the system is equitable, responsive, efficient, and flexible. We are, again, not recommending specific levels of funding because that really is an adequacy lens, and that really at this point is responsibility of the legislature to determine in as far as our study goes, but we were looking at what could be adjustments to your structure. And so we really are going to talk about what we heard, what we learned, what we saw, and then talk about what, you know, the recommendations themselves.
And Justin, could I also just loop you back one more time here that, well, it's not on this slide. Reiterate your appreciation for the fiscal sustainability relationship to this and just whatever you're looking at both efficiency measures here, but where it might be imputed for an additional cost or an additional obligation somewhere, you recognize, I'd rather it not be my words, but you recognize the difficulties the state is in right now.
Absolutely. And that was in my notes for the next slide, but we can, Mr. Chairman, we can move to that slide and I'll mention that again. So I'll just start there, which is that we want to keep in mind that any change that we might recommend, one, has to be taken into account in the current fiscal environment, and so we have to make sure we understand that. And keeping that in mind, what we are hearing from interviewees and some of the, I think, concern that if you make a change in a zero-sum environment, there is by definition a winner and a loser. And we are analyzing, does everyone have enough? What we're analyzing is this structure, a sound structure for the differences you face in your state. And so there are recommendations here that probably, that would have could have a fiscal impact. But what we're really making the recommendations, we understand the current construct, and we also understand that trying to implement within that zero-sum game can be very difficult. So we're laying everything out for where we should go. But we just, you're keeping all of that in mind as we do it. And so, I think really the best news coming out of the general impressions as we get into the recommendations is that overall we really do think that the current structure of your funding system is strong and that it takes into account the needs that districts and students and schools face in Alaska. And so as we get further into the recommendations, I think you'll notice that the vast majority are really changes to your current structure. They're changes within your current structure. They are not changes to the structure. And so we think, again, that the type of adjustments that you're making are sound and they are responsive, but that you might want to address how you're making those, and we're recommending that you might do them a little differently, but we're not saying, get rid of everything you've done and start to do something totally new. That was really our goal was to first see, should you be getting rid of things and doing something different, and then underneath that, or if it's a sound structure, are there adjustments you can make to better serve those students is the lens that we get down to, how do you best serve students?
Senator McKinnon, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the issues that has been under consideration by previous LBNA committees, not necessarily this one, had been the issue of if other states were using different components in structuring their foundation formula. I'm not sure what other states call their funding mechanisms, but for our foundation formula, if there were other components being used in other states or other districts across the nation that we somehow haven't considered that would be applicable in ours, are you getting to that in your presentation, or was it considered in ours looked like they were considering essentially enough of those particular components that were allowable federally under the equity and equality issue for education funding?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we definitely looked at a number of other states and we looked at the scope of what they're doing. We have a background on that. You will not see a specific recommendation to bring anything new in. Mm-hmm. I think really what you'll see more of is adjusting what you currently have to probably expand it, which will then include more of what some other states are doing, but it would be similar to the construct you have. And so we definitely took a look to say, is there some adjustment you're just not making at all that you need to make? And as we go through the recommendations, you'll see, and others might view it a little differently. They might say, well, that really seems new. But I think as we walk through here, we think it's really adjustments to the general current structure of your formula, but we definitely looked at that.
Thank you, Justin. Please continue.
So, again, just to review, those adjustments that we're talking about is that school size adjustment, the hold harmless, district cost factor, your special needs funding, your vocational, career, and technical education funding, and there's a lot of names that have floated around that with that adjustment. So we're going to call it CTE as we walk through the adjustments. Your intensive services funding and your correspondence funding, and then we will also talk about capital and transportation and some other general recommendations that we have. So the last slide was really talking about kind of those, again, that generally the formula seems to be in a good place, and that when we talked to districts and we looked at the structure, it seemed to be working well in the state. Some of the concerns that we would have, and this comes out of a lot of the information that we that Amanda talked about, is that there are a couple spots in your current formula where we would say there are cliffs. And to that we mean, you know, a change in one or a handful of students, theoretically and mathematically, could lead to a pretty large change in funding. And so that is one of those pieces when we're looking at the efficiency and effectiveness of a formula. We wouldn't want to see, well, I can lose one or two students, and that means I either get a lot more or, you know, a lot less funding. It can, one, build in some perverse incentives, and two, it just is, you know, cliffs, just not something we want to see. Going back to what Amanda pointed out, your SBA performance, your performance of students, seems to be linked statistically to the characteristics.
Justin, just as a presentation point, I know, you know, you've got the acronyms, you've described them, but again, we've got ourselves as well as other people listening, and we're creating a record that people will be referring back to. And if I could just ask you to speak the acronym out rather than just hit us with the acronym.
I have been calling it SBA for 4 months, so I don't have to go back in. We'll hit that one.
Standards-based assessment. Thank you. Thank you, audience.
Yes, and so that's a good point. You know, we're looking at the standards-based assessment. That assessment is shifting, but it is the data we had at the time, and so that is what we're looking at. But the performance assessments, your special education students, your limited English proficiency students, and your Alaska Native students, it's statistically significant. The more of those students you have, the lower your performance will be. So there is that link. We also notice that when we look at other states and we look at your funding system really does not differentiate on a student basis. And so I know it's called a student, it's a student-based formula. But when you look at the funding system, we actually are not funding any specific students. So you're not funding students who are identified as Alaska Native. You're not funding LEP students. You're not limited English proficiency students. You're not funding non-intensive special education students at the student level. And so that is really back to the point that that special needs weight is a 0.20, and it's applied the same across all districts, regardless of their number of students in those categories. And so that is very different than what most other states are doing today. When they have special needs funding, it is tied to actual student numbers or percentages. There are a couple of the existing adjustments, so both the school size adjustment and the district cost factor adjustment, that haven't been reevaluated in a number of years. The school size adjustment hasn't been looked at in, it's approaching 2 decades, and the district cost factor in about a decade. And so, you know, they're good figures that just haven't been looked at recently. We have equity concerns that arise around the difficulty, really, in comparing wealth across districts. When you have your regional education districts and you have your city and borough districts, and those districts have very different tax policy and structure, it creates there's a real barrier to evaluating the equity especially at the fiscal, the taxpayer equity level. It's really impossible to do. And then finally, currently I'm looking at that fiscal sustainability, oil tax revenues are declining, and then they're predicted to remain lower than they have been. And so you have that sustainability piece. And so here are our specific recommendations. So our first recommendation, the way we've laid out the slides is it's similar to the report, you know, in the bold is the recommendation. Underneath that in the report is a lot of background, and that's just how we'll do that here. So the first piece is Alaska should consider not using the school size adjustment in your largest districts. And that really is looking at both how other states adjust for school size. So other states often are adjusting for school size at what they call the necessarily small school. So schools who are in a setting where really they're the only population of schools. And so if there is a small school, it's there. It's the only school that's going to be able to serve the students, and so you're going to adjust for size. As they get into larger districts, they don't tend to adjust as frequently for small school set sites in larger settings where you have perhaps some more capacity to build through central operations some economies of scale. So I think it's important to say we are not saying that funding for your largest district should go down at the school size adjustment level. What we're saying is that there could be some incentives built in to building smaller schools because you'll get more dollars per student with a smaller school population. We're not saying it's happening. We're not saying we know it's happening. But it is, as we talk about, kind of perverse incentives in the system. And then you also have students in those largest districts who are in the largest schools who are actually being funded at the school size adjustment level below 1.0. Yeah, that's just the way the formula works. And so we're really recommending that. We're not saying change the funding, but consider a way to take into account the cost structures needed in the large districts, but making sure you don't provide incentive to have capital campaigns, especially to build certain size schools that aren't necessarily the most efficient or effective school sizes you might have in a larger district.
Excuse me, Senator Kirk, Senator McKinnon, ma'am.
Thank you.
Apologies for that again.
Mr. Chairman. We've worked together a
long way too long.
Did you consider the federal mandate that the state of Alaska received in making this particular recommendation when it comes to this recommendation? So at statehood, after statehood, when we took over the educational responsibilities from the federal government, there was this issue of equitable funding, mm-hmm. and also, which was different than equal funding. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not recalling the specific variables, but there were several of them that the state is trying to keep in mind in the current funding proposal. We are trying to reach our highest compliance with what the federal government and our responsibilities are to our students. Mm-hmm. So was that a consideration, and this does not violate the equitable clause?
Mm-hmm.
And where it circles back to is you've nailed it, that larger cities that have taxing capacity tax, and they want to tax at a higher rate. And so we've fixed what they could tax on themselves to try to make sure that we kept this equitable issue in the forefront of our thought.
So, Mr. Chairman, we did look at that equity issue and the impact of kind of that federal lens more on the, when we're looking at the overall funding system, and to your point, when we're looking at those caps on the additional local that can be provided. As we look at most of these recommendations, we think they are targeted towards student need, which is really, when you talk about equitable versus equal, really that's the way we think of equity. You know, equitable really is about serving students at their level of need. And so, and they are definitely adjustments that are used all across the country. In the way that we'll talk about them. So they have been generally accepted as ways to ensure not an equal but an equitable formula because you're addressing the differences of students. And so for us, there was a little bit of a separation between when we're looking at the funding side and ensuring, as we would look through, you know, the 25% differential on expenditure, that wasn't as, or on revenue, that didn't play into this specific recommendation, but as we put in our recommendations about how to fund districts, they're all about equity of student, how best to serve the differences of students or schools or districts across the state.
So through the chair, I would say any recommendations that the state decide to move forward with, you would need to run that equity test that allows you to use your federal impact aid to make sure that difference between districts does not exceed, I think it's the 23% off the top of my head. So you would have to look at that once you determined which of the adjustments that you wanted to make changes to. We didn't evaluate that test on each of them independently because you may be using one from here, one from there, and combined they would have different impacts.
Senator McKinnon, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to follow up, then the issue becomes if we pass the federal bar, we have issues like the Ketchikan lawsuit
mm-hmm.
that, again, it's a whole sum game. No one wins, from my perspective, at least mm-hmm. in that scenario, because everyone will receive less if cities that have wealth or areas that have wealth are unable to contribute.
Mm-hmm.
And the state continues to face an economic downturn mm-hmm. with lack of revenue. So. So for us, even though it might be a recommendation that meets the federal hurdle, then we would have to stand mm-hmm. against each district that may choose to sue the state for inequitable treatment if the formula changes. Just a concern. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please continue, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next recommendation is districts should be allowed to pick which school the student in a community under 10 are applied to. So currently in the formula, any school, or in its, there's this confluence, and so I'll talk about it, and I'm sure I'm going to stumble all over it because it's complex. But there's, within the school size adjustment, there's a community, there's a community lens. And so there are certain benchmarks, and we mentioned this earlier when we talk about these cliffs, where in a community with under 10 students, there is not, those students are not applied into the school size adjustment. Those students are actually added to the next smallest school in the district for funding purposes before they're run through the school size adjustment table. And so what that means is that you have your most likely smallest school, 10, which is no longer funded, being added to your next smallest school, which then also raises their enrollment, which actually lowers the amount they're going to get per pupil once they hit a threshold of, say, around 40 students. And so one of the recommendations in talking to those around the state is that, and then also looking at how other states do this, there are a few states who cut funding for their smallest schools, and that goes back to this necessarily small school adjustment, and there are states who have districts who are under 10. And so in this lens, I'm trying to think through both what is a policy decision that's been made in Alaska, but also try to provide some flexibility, which is one of our tenets. As we look at your structure, we are recommending that those community, the districts who have these schools under 10, which are no longer run through the school size adjustment, that they have the flexibility to put those 10 students onto the school they find would be most efficient for them. And so we have not run every iteration. We don't know if anybody would make a different decision. But we heard enough times that, you know, you take my second smallest school, you make them a little bigger, I lose funding in that really small, high-cost area, and it might be better if I had some flexibility to look at it a little differently. And generally, cost-wise, it might actually, you know, it might not be a huge issue. So that's a recommendation. So our next recommendation is still on the school size adjustment, and it really comes back to this idea of cliffs, and it comes back into this community adjustment that is part of the school size adjustment. And so the best example we have here, so the recommendation is Alaska should create an average formula for schools affected by the community size cliffs at 100 and 425 students. And so currently, and the example that we use a lot in the report is you got 101 students. A school is funded, really is two schools, and so their K-6 and 712 are both run separately through the school size table. At 100, one less student, they're run through as a single site. And that difference is around 18 ADM at that one time. If you then add on the kind of multiplicative issue that you have where you, after you do your school size adjustment, you're also doing a district cost factor, you're also applying special needs and the CTE adjustment, that can get closer like 40 students of change in funding based on kind of one or two students. Now again, is it happening every year, every place? Probably not. But we did hear enough times from, as we did interviews across the state, that there are times where we have 102 one year and we have 98 the next year, and we're seeing a pretty big shift in funding to the districts, but we're not going to be dramatically changing the structure of what we do at that school because we've lost four students. Or we've gained four students. And so what we were looking at here is providing, and it would add an area of complexity for the DED to track, but providing basically a kind of averaging over time, and we're going to talk about this kind of declining enrollment factor later on, and using a similar approach to say, well, we're going to try to smooth out those differences if you have schools who are consistently at these cliff points, and so that they aren't jumping up and down. So, again, biggest piece here was looking at a formula and trying to eliminate cliffs, not having places where you have big jumps. We tried to run some different math where you could maybe just smooth these curves, and it just doesn't make a lot of sense. It would be a lot of effort, and it would actually cost you more throughout the whole system than just looking at places who are going above or above or below and making the sort of smoothing adjustment within that community provision. Okay, and then the final school size adjustment recommendation is the school size adjustment was first created in 98, so it may be time to update the adjustment. One piece here is that as you're updating the adjustment, I think it's important to set what a base education is for students. So what would you really be talking about? And again, it's not equal. You know, you can't expect that the smallest districts in the state can provide the exact same program as the largest districts of their state or some, you know, some mix between there. But kind of what is a general program you'd like to see every student be able to receive? And it can be done different ways so that as you set the school size adjustment, you would be able to think through what kind of what are you purchasing in a general sense. Okay. So next we're going to move on to hold harmless. So the recommendation is Alaska should create a true declining enrollment adjustment to replace the current hold harmless provision. This declining enrollment adjustment would be applied to all districts to ensure greater funding stability. So I think the first piece to talk about here is as we researched Alaska's hold harmless provision, the first thing we thought as we looked at it is that this is really a declining enrollment adjustment. So a classic hold harmless provision in school finance language is that you ensure a district would have the same level of funding, total level of funding, going forward. And so just the naming of it a little bit just on its own is a little bit of a misnomer. And if you actually look at a report from Temple University that looks at all the hold harmless and declining enrollment adjustments across the country, they consider Alaska's hold harmless provision a declining enrollment provision just because of what it's doing. And so that was the first lens. And the second piece about the current hold harmless provision is it's another place where you might have a cliff. Because you have an absolute targeted amount, 5% reduction of students in a year, reduction of your school size adjustment population in a year, you could have a district that has 4.9% and a district that has 5.0. One is going to be getting this, what we really say is kind of a stabilizing of its decrease over time, and the other won't. And you can, again, mathematically find situations where you could have a district losing far more students over a 2 or 3 year period than, and not be getting this hold harmless provision than a district who hit this 5% in 1 year, but let's say then flattens out. And so it has some real effects on funding. Again, if it were to happen, this is math and just trying to look at those places where cliffs exist, and we go through some of those numbers in the report. So we then also looked at a number of different approaches to thinking about this. And so different states use different approaches to trying to work with declining enrollment. You could look at prior year funding. You could look at what you call weighted averaging. And so what you would do there is you'd say, this year's ADM is worth 50%, and last year's is 30%, and the year before is 20%. You can create these somewhat complex formulas. What that means, those type of formulas, any growing district isn't going to be capturing their growth. But what it does, well, so for that type, they will never be capturing their full growth in a given year, whereas what we are recommending is really a best-of-3-year average, which a number of states use some concept like this, which is basically to say you get your best of current year's school size adjusted ADM, the average of the past 2 years, or the average of the prior 3 years. And what this also addresses is we heard frequently from districts that they have some real uncertainty with their budgeting. So they are relying on estimates for their October count at the same time that they, you know, the budget is just going through the legislature, and there's real concern year to year about what that number is going to come out at in October. And if they make a, you know, if the numbers are off, you could really lose, you know, larger numbers of staff than you can really absorb. And so this sort of declining enrollment adjustment would keep everybody a little bit more steady over time.
Senator McKinnon, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To move to that system, certainly there would be financial consequences for the state. Can you tell me who, or if you can remember, who uses the best three-year averaging approach, and then what type of states they are as far as similar to Alaska or different than Alaska?
Yeah.
The majority of states that use a three-year flattening, the five?
And I don't have them all on the top of my head, but, you know, for example, you know, we're from Colorado, Denver, and so I'll mention Colorado because it's just a system that it's on my mind because I'm building some models for them right now, and they use a multi-year average. Same way, they actually would use a couple more years than 3 years. And so where you often see these are in states with smaller, more rural settings where you have a large amount of decline. And that decline as a percentage can be pretty large year to year. I mean, a few students in a very small district can have a large chunk. One of the pieces I failed to mention here also that we heard is that some of your mid-sized districts, you know, it's hard to get to 5%, but when you're losing 100 or 200 students, that's a, it's a large amount of funding to lose. So that's the other piece they were trying to address. Yeah, and in the report is the number, and it wasn't as large as I would actually, as you would think, the amount of change that would it would take. It would be, to implement this, would be a big impact on those districts currently on the 5% threshold, but overall it's not actually a huge change in ADM in any one given year.
Senator McKinnon, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, you've given us one example, Colorado. Did you say that in the report it will tell me how many more, and could you tell the general public then, is it a handful or is it 50% of the states use that?
So, yeah, we did not look at all 50 states and say who was looking at PACE. We were looking at comparison states and states who do similar things. So it's in the report on the others who use that declining enrollment. Look, yeah.
Representative Keto.
Thank you. Thank you, Justin. The question I have, I guess, is regarding the best of three, and that's the best of 3 years of actual students in the classroom after or before adjustments, correct?
So, Mr. Chairman, what we modeled was the best of three school size adjusted ADM. And so it's after the school size adjustment has been applied, which is where currently the hold harmless is applied, is after the school size adjustment has been made. So taking that same framework, once the school size adjustment is made, then taking their best of 3 year average, so in
October count.
From the October count after the school size adjustment is made.
Okay, thank you. Please continue, sir.
Okay. So we are now moving on to the district cost factor. When we looked at the district cost factor, our first recommendation is the study team believes Alaska's district cost factor is strong. The current district cost factor is also the most appropriate approach for the state. So there are just a handful of states who actually use any sort of cost of living adjustment at all across the state. And so we, and they differ from what we'd really call cost of living adjustments or cost of education adjustments. And so Alaska, we would consider a cost of education adjustment. It's really looking at those factors that impact the cost of education in your various communities across the state. Some states even, you know, use more of a cost of living, so they're looking at a basket of goods that aren't necessarily related to what it takes to provide education services, but really what it costs for their employees to live in certain places. So Virginia is an example of a state who uses a cost of living adjustment, and they actually only apply it to those districts that are closest to Washington, D.C. So they're applying it for, again, very specific cost drivers. Some other states, and there actually are less, you know, less states who are doing this, right, Maryland also uses this, Colorado uses this, but it's just a handful of states who currently use this type of adjustment. But in a state where we see, in Alaska, where you see very large variation in cost to provide education, we think this is a good approach. It does lead into the second recommendation, which is that given that it's been 10 years since the last update of the DCF, it may be time to update the information in the district cost factor study to ensure it is responsive to current district needs. Based on the interviews, there was some concern from school district leadership that costs had shifted some, and this is in part back to some of this fixed cost versus non-fixed cost, and so that's one piece. Two other cost areas that we heard frequently that people would like to hear addressed or see addressed perhaps is the cost of student activities. There are certain settings, and I know student activities, student sports, athletics, that it can be a third rail in any state, but we heard it enough, we need to talk about it, that there are certain communities who they feel if you wanted an equitable experience for students, they have a much higher cost of providing that experience. So that's something you could look at if you were addressing this. And then there's also this cost of travel for some of your education specialists, especially around your highest need special education students. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. That to provide the same service for a student in a much more remote setting, it can just be much more costly. And again, all of this we would want to frame in allowing there to be really good resources available for the instructional program side. So as you're looking at these district cost differences, it's really trying to think about, well, how do you address kind of that, the cost that it just takes to be out there and provide this education
so that you're really freeing up as many resources as possible and as efficient as you can to provide educational dollars, which we've seen are linked to, you know, getting higher performance for students. So the next area is the special needs funding, and we've mentioned a couple times that, you know, Alaska's current system is not what we consider student-based. It is not funding for special needs on specific students. It is the block grant model. Our recommendation here is that they should move towards a series of adjustments for special needs that are student population-specific and need-differentiated. The state should also consider providing an adjustment for at-risk students. And so in the report, you will see in a number of different places our data analysis on the differences across districts with these student populations. And you have wide variation in limited English proficiency students, special education students, what we would call low-income or at-risk students, and Alaska Native students. The concentrations of those students in your 53 different districts is very, very large. And so you have some districts with the data we have that have very small concentrations. We have some who have very, very high concentrations. And so there is difference in student population. And that most states who are applying a limited English proficiency adjustment or an at-risk adjustment, they are doing that more on a student basis. There's a little bit more differential in how special education is being applied. Some states use what they call a census-based approach, which is more like your block grant approach, assuming every district has the same level of need and the same distribution of students. But when you talk about your limited English proficiency or your at-risk or low-income, that is generally far more student-based, and you're funding the differences in districts so that they have the equitable dollars to provide differentiated services. So we looked at a number of different approaches to how you might want to, how you could make this adjustment. We applied some weights that are out there, and you can see this in the report, but when you look at actually applying weights to actual student count for the non-intensive special education students, your low-income students, your Alaska Native, and your limited English proficiency students, you can actually use some weights that would be considered, you know, well in line with what states are doing today. And your numbers in the long term would not be very different than what you're currently providing in your special needs adjustment. In the short term, if you're trying, you know, it could have either very large differential for an individual district, or you could have to do some, we would really recommend holding some harmless, so it could have a cost. But over time, you could apply some weights that would fund the same amount, or close to the same amount, but it would differentiate by student. What it would also do is it would disconnect your special needs funding from those other adjustments. And so it would really be its own set of adjustments. You would no longer multiply them off your district cost factor and your special needs factor, and your school size adjustment.
Senator McKinnon, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your analysis, did you consider litigation that school districts are facing in trying to meet the needs of special circumstances inside of each school, children with disabilities, compared to other states that may have different levels of service that they provide inside of the building?
Mr. Chairman, we did not look specifically at any link to litigation. And again, this is where it was a little, you know, we weren't looking at adequacy, so we weren't looking at what is the level of funding that's either being provided or needed to be provided. So we weren't looking specifically there. What we were really looking at the district level is how much differentiation do you have in that level of student need in different settings? And so really trying to understand, you know, on average, do districts look the same across the state? On average, do they look different? And districts look very different when you think about the types of students who are walking through the door based on the demographic data that we were using.
Madam.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I understand it, in comparison to, say, Washington, Alaska steps up to the plate in a very different way in delivering special needs students services inside of our schools. And so that's where I was driving at. I mean, we want an integrated classroom that has people with disabilities able to function as well as they can inside of those circumstances, where I have at least heard other states may provide less services, which is going into the instructional dollar of providing services for those individual students.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think, and this is the last point on the slide, you know, one of the things we did hear frequently is that within the block grant for special needs funding, the first place that Alaska districts are going with that funding is for their non-intensive special needs students. So there is this additional funding for their intensive special needs students, which we'll talk about in a little bit, which I think in both pots you're trying to provide those services, Senator, that you're speaking of. But what we heard repeatedly is that when you look at that block grant, the first place those dollars are going is to serve the non-intensive special needs students and provide those services. And when there are dollars, other dollars, they're going to look at vocational and gifted and talented and bilingual bicultural. But right now, with the way it is, you know, if you have a very high concentration of students, especially of your non-intensive special ed, most of those dollars are going to go to that population because it's this block grant and it's not differentiated by need. Okay. So the next recommendation is around the career technical education funding. APA believes Alaska should leave the career and technical education adjustment in place. When funding is available, the state should consider if it is possible to increase the level of funding and fund actual career technical education student counts. And so again, the career technical education funding is done on a kind of block grant model, actually applied to K through 12 populations and then used for your 7 through 12 student populations. We heard from every group we talked to that this WAIT has done a very good job at helping districts provide this type of career and technical education support that they want to provide. They feel in a state like Alaska where there are a number of jobs that are high paying that you can get that don't require a higher education degree, that the expansion of career and technical education is very important. But again, you know, we think if there were funding, this is a good place to target some of those funds because we heard very strong support for the WAIT itself. And then I think just the underlying question becomes, would you want to make it more student specific? So if you have more of those populations, you would get more funding. I think a big caveat to that is that some of your districts will say, you know, it's harder to provide a more robust program in some of the smaller settings. So I think you would want to balance that as you made that decision. The next recommendation is around intensive services funding. Alaska should not make any major changes to the current intensive services adjustment. And so you currently fund your intensive services students at a 13 weight. And we recognize in looking across the country that that's a high weight. I mean, that weight is higher than what other states are using. At the same time, you have to adjust for what that base level is that it's being applied to. So this adjustment is not part of all the different multiplication. It is 13.
Would you like to take a break for a second and get...
So the 13 is adjusted only to the base need.
Well, let's just take a quick at ease here. We'll give everybody a couple of minutes break. Let's. At this point, if it's all right, I realize we're interrupting your slide, but we'll hold off until about the top of the hour and then reconvene. By their consulting firm. We were on page 32 of the recommendations PowerPoint talking about our intensive services funding. So, Justin, if you'd reintroduce yourself for the record, and let's continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Justin Silverstein with APA Consulting, and I'm going to try to make it through, and if the voice goes entirely, then Amanda will tap me on the shoulder and take over. So we were discussing the intensive services funding recommendation that Alaska should not make any major changes to the intensive services adjustment. We talked about the weight is high, but that's in relationship, one, to the base that is that it's multiplied against, and also the fact that the state doesn't provide what other states call extraordinary aid funding. So in a host of other states, in different approaches, but in a host of other states, the very highest need students over a certain threshold, the state picks up the full cost of those students or some percentage of that cost. Your weight, your approach does not do that, but it does have a higher weight. So we think the current structure is a good structure. Additional recommendations with the intensive services funding. If the state does re-examine the district cost factor, the study team suggests examining the additional cost of providing related services for intensive special education students in remote or isolated areas. So I think first we want to say we are not recommending applying the district cost factor to the intensive services funding. We're not saying multiply those two together. What we were hearing and what we're trying what we think should be examined if there is a look at the district cost factor again is that there are some services provided by therapists who have to travel from more urban areas to very remote settings, and to provide the same level of service to a student with the same disability in a very remote or isolated area might cost substantially more than it would in a more urban setting. And so we heard this enough times, we think, again, we're not making a recommendation of exactly what that looks like, but if you were to re-look at the district cost factor, it'd be something to take into account as you made that examination.
Senator McKinnon, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In relationship to that comment, you heard that from districts, which is leading me to believe that they're bringing people in to help. I, a long time ago, had a K-12 education budget, and we embedded inside of the education department the funding for that travel. So are you telling me that districts are being charged something for that, or it's been removed at the state level for travel, or can you tell me specifically how districts have been affected by that?
Yeah, through the chair, we did not hear a lot about the state picking up those costs. Mostly we heard about, it didn't come up in the interviews. They just mentioned that there can be high costs to bringing folks out, and they mentioned a lot of the travel difficulties that they'd be paying time for the person as they're traveling here. If there's any weather-related issues and they're held up somewhere, they're having to pick up that time above and beyond the time for service. So we didn't hear that from the districts about the state picking up a piece, so I wonder if it's the distinction between the cost of the travel and the cost of the time of the person to travel that maybe we didn't catch that nuance. But I am not sure because it just didn't come up.
Mr. Chairman, if I might follow up, districts could have specialized teaching staff that they're sending out to other schools in their region, which it would make sense on that comment, but we have been providing education specialists to go out specifically in districts that have met a particular threshold but needed assistance, and so the state took on that responsibility based on a previous lawsuit. So it would be interesting to look at that thought a little bit more. Thank you.
Okay. And then the last recommendation is Alaska should collect data on the movement of intensive special education students into and out of districts throughout the year to understand the potential cost impact for districts due to this mobility. So this is really a data examination, something we were unable to do as part of this study. But what we've heard is that with intensive special needs students, the type of interventions and services they need really varies very specifically by student. And so if you have a student who comes in mid-year or after the October count, you can have very high costs that aren't necessarily funded in that year. And even if the net sum of those intensive services students in a year is zero, so you lose one and you gain one, the differences in the types of services they need are so different that there really is additional cost for having a student that isn't fully reimbursed. So again, that was just really looking to see if that movement is at a scale that you would really want to address or not, and if the differences in services needed within that movement. So you'd want to look both at the students and the types of disabilities, when and where are they moving, and then what types of services are they provided. We're moving on to the correspondence program. So Alaska is unique in its approach to providing a publicly funded homeschool option. There are other states do not provide the funding for this homeschool option. Just a few states do that. We want to really point out we are only examining the publicly funded homeschool through the correspondence programs. We were not looking at the non-publicly funded homeschool, and we understand that's an important aspect of education in the state, but it wasn't within the purview of our study. And so our recommendations around correspondence programs is if a new system is put in place where we're looking at actual student counts for special needs funding, Alaska should consider adjusting for special needs of correspondent students. So if there are students who are not currently receiving, you know, a special education or something that is funded, if there are services being provided around LEP or any limited English proficiency or any other special needs category to correspondents or homeschool students that isn't being picked up in cost, we should examine to see if that's happening. We've heard about students who have these types of needs where the funding doesn't
isn't provided because the correspondence funding is outside of the formula where the block grant is for special needs. So we'd want to take a look again first at the student counts before you decided to make any type of adjustments. The next recommendation is we heard repeatedly about a movement to blended learning. So if blended learning programs grow, then Alaska should examine the cost of the programs and the methods for counting blended learning students. So blended learning programs, when they're really implemented, are students who are receiving part of their instruction off-site and part of their instruction on-site. And there are factors in your system that would allow for a student who's taking courses to be counted as a part-time student. And so in theory, that could work. You could, we were hearing that to implement this fully, the districts are a little bit afraid that the current system doesn't quite address the structure where you're having students come in, but they're not necessarily in classes, right? They're coming to the school to have support in a blended learning environment, but that's not necessarily in a class. And so the cost structure of your correspondence funding, it doesn't necessarily align to this movement of blended learning. It is a growing population across the country, and so it came up enough times we wanted to mention, again, a look at it, but not a specific recommendation on what to do. Transportation. The recommendation is the study team does not recommend changes to the current transportation funding system and suggests that districts continue to be allowed to use their transportation funding for what we're calling intra-district transportation. And so transportation funding across the country varies widely. There are a number of different types of formulas and different approaches to funding transportation. Here in Alaska, it's a per-pupil amount based on some historical data. And generally, districts were happy with the transportation funding. Not every district, but generally, you know, the 31 districts we talked to, they were happy with that. They mentioned, you know, repeatedly that there's somewhat a lack of competition, and so it can be a struggle to when they go out for contract because there just isn't a lot of option. And so want to look at that. With the intra-district piece, there was some mention that there's some new accounting going on and the different types of use of transportation. And so, you know, to and from school is going to be evaluated differently than if students are being moved from program to program within a district. Many of the larger districts do that, where they might have a career tech education center, which allows them to what they think provide them far more robust opportunity for all students in that area, and they use transportation to facilitate that during the day, and they just want to ensure that within the funding structure that would still be allowed. And they feel that, you know, if you got rid of that, that cost is going to have to come from somewhere if you want to keep as effective an approach for those programs. Capital. We are not making any specific recommendation around capital. As you probably know, and if you don't, capital funding probably varies more than any other type of funding for schools across the country. There are states who provide basically no funding for capital. There are states who pick up almost the whole cost, and it ranges everywhere in between. And so, you know, it obviously the condition of facilities is very important for the education of students, and there's research that talks about that, and we mentioned some of that in our report. We know that those districts in the state who have declining enrollments and who have structures and a kind of a fixed cost setup that is much larger than their current student count are struggling, and they've mentioned this, they're struggling to be as their percent of kind of operation and maintenance costs of total expenditures grows and grows because you have basically a smaller denominator on the same amount of cost or a similar cost. And, you know, districts mentioned that, you know, elimination of the debt reimbursement program, it could, is a real issue. And they felt that that was one way they could really leverage support in the community because there would be state dollars that could come in. So we're not making any specific recommendation, but, it, you know, it is important to remember that the capital costs for districts can be high. The long-term maintenance costs can be a real issue across the board, and any loss of capital funding is a real issue for districts over time. Okay, so to the equity study, and I think the chairman mentioned this before, there are a ton of metrics and analysis and statistics in the equity section, which really are the basis for a lot of this. We invite everyone to read that. There are some very structured approaches to looking at what is equitable, both on the horizontal, vertical, and fiscal neutrality. The recommendations around this are the study team recommends that Alaska revisit its special needs adjustment to ensure that it accounts for differences in concentrations of special needs students, especially at-risk students across districts. We've already talked about that in the special needs funding, what our recommendation would be. This comes out of the equity study again, because when you look at your vertical equity, the equity across districts once you've adjusted for need, even when you adjust for the current factors in Alaska school finance formula, you have an equity issue. So basically what it means is all these additional dollars coming on top outside of the formula, outside of the mandated local match, create some equity issues that aren't necessarily related to student need. And so you want to take a look at that. And one way we think you can do that is through the characteristics. The next recommendation is the state should conduct further analysis of the differences in the amount of local revenues contributed to districts and explore approaches for either equalizing access to additional revenues beyond state foundation funding for low-wealth districts or further limiting the amount of additional local funding that may be contributed to districts. So this is around a horizontal equity issue where when you're looking just across how much do districts have to spend, you currently allow additional local dollars to come in. There's only certain set of districts who actually have access to those additional dollars. It can create some equity concerns. And our last equity recommendation, and we talked about this a bit earlier, the state should consider creating a consistent measure of local capacity for supporting districts that may be used across all district types. And so we tried to create a wealth proxy, which we explained further in the report, finding some way to really talk about what is the local fiscal capacity of districts is a big piece of trying to figure out what the equity, especially at that fiscal neutrality for taxpayers, what that looks like. And with the split between your REA districts and your city and borough districts, it becomes difficult to make that comparison currently. And our final set of recommendations are on fiscal neutrality. So again, we want to start it all off with, as we talk about this, we understand that there is not another revenue source in the state that can replace your oil revenues. There's nothing you could do to just swap that out. But as we talk about this, we are talking again about your flexibility and the ability to be flexible over time. We are asked to look at the fiscal sustainability, and so this is what we're laying out. First is over the long term, it may be in the state's best interest to begin moving toward reducing its reliance on oil revenues. So we talked about this already. In the long term, demand and production will likely begin a permanent downward trend. And so if there was an ability to put in new revenue streams, again, it's not going to replace it, but it might give you some flexibility with your current kind of 80 to 90% of funds coming from really one general source. If there were a transition away from your oil revenues, we are recommending that you could look at the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund and the Permanent Fund Earnings Reserve accounts, and we are looking at the beginning FY 2016 balances. You know, there are billions of dollars in those accounts. Again, that would be perhaps a temporary a way to help transition between your current oil revenues and a shift to some other to an additional revenue stream.
And could I again emphasize here, this section in here really is stating the obvious in the face of what we know at this state. And respectfully, you did not attempt here to present a fiscal policy solution for us, but just pointing out the obvious.
Yes. Thank you, Chairman. That's true. I think the next recommendation around fiscal sustainability moves a little bit away from that piece, which is Alaska pays for a relatively high state share of K-12 funding. The state should explore equitable approaches to adjusting the local share of K-12 funding. And so you'd have to do it within the context of the equity and the federal issues that we talked about. But and we will reiterate, we understand there's the Ketchikan lawsuit, and that was not part of our purview, and it would change this discussion dramatically. Currently, Alaska funds 64.8% of the K-12 funding, and the national average is around 45%. So you're funding a higher percentage of your overall pot. You're currently limiting the amount of local contribution to 45% of basic need. And so you could look at eliminating that cap or moving that cap to allow certain districts to provide a higher percentage of the total of their total education pot.
Representative Keto, sir.
Thank you, Justin. I'm a little confused. I think that seems to go contrary to one of the earlier recommendations of actually providing more compressed funding to equalize on the horizontal side. So if you're allowing for more local contribution, then there are some districts that can't provide that additional local contribution, which means it would push them outside that horizontal equity. So that's...
Mr. Chairman, in this case, what we're trying to talk about, and so I apologize if it's not clear, is the 45%, the 45% cap is on the required local contribution. And so if a district's 2.65 mils would produce more than 45% of their total basic need, they're capped. They don't have to go to the 2.65. And so what this is saying is that you would actually let, and we're not telling you what that percentage would be, this is all on the local, this is on the required amount, not on the additional amount that can come above. So the total pot of dollars between state and local would stay the same when you're just thinking about the basic aid calculation. It's just that more would be coming from local than state. It would reduce the state share and it would increase the local share. So it isn't the additional dollars above.
Okay, thank you.
The state could also consider creating a floor for the impact aid percent applied to city and borough districts making effort above the required level. This would lower the amount of state aid provided to these districts. So currently in the calculation, federal impact aid is used as really somewhat of an offset to the amount of state aid provided. City and borough districts who provide local contribution above the mandatory, the required amount, basically are given credit for that. In that it reduces the amount of federal impact aid that is applied to the 90% number, which is then the amount of federal impact aid that is deducted from state aid. It's a somewhat complex formula, and it's laid out better than what I just said in the report. So a district who has a very high additional local effort above the required has a very low percentage amount, and that percentage amount, let's say it's 10%, is applied to their federal impact aid, which lowers the amount of impact aid that can be used in this calculation, which actually increases the state aid needed for that district. There's a lot of moving parts here. So you could think about creating some sort of, it's really a floor, I keep wanting to say cap, but because it's moving down, it's really a floor, saying perhaps every district has to provide at least, has to have a 30% factor. Because there are districts below that. We're not saying what that number should be, but it's something you could look into, which would, again, would perhaps provide a little bit more fiscal sustainability in the system because it would tap more local dollars.
And Justin, again, you're talking about C&B districts, C&B?
Sorry, city and borough districts.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay. We're almost there. Fiscal sustainability, again, as noted in the equity study recommendations, the state should also consider formally defining and measuring the local fiscal capacity of all districts. So we already talked about that piece, but in order to really understand what's happening at the local level, you need to be able to compare. And then the last two slides are other recommendations that are not specific to any one component of the funding system, but were pieces that really came up as we did this whole study, and there's only two more slides. And so the first piece, the first recommendation is, Alaska should undertake an examination of the state's current school district governance structure to ensure it's the most efficient and effective approach to serving students. So we, as we made this examination, we were examining your current structure of school finance system and your current governance structure, and how does your structure relate to that current governance structure. What we found is that there are places where you could observe districts and two districts who might even be housed in the same town serving, and you have just you have central offices serving two districts who are in a similar area. One is a city and borough district, and one is an REAA district. And so, again, we are not saying we know you could be more efficient. We're not saying it's exactly what could happen, but we are saying it's something you could evaluate. There are some barriers to that, obviously, and one of those barriers is the current tax structure. And so you have, districts sitting next to each other who have very different tax structures. It's hard to think about your efficiencies when you kind of have different rules for the game. And so, again, something to consider and look at, but not something that was in the purview of this study. And then the last recommendation is Alaska should examine student enrollment trends through the year.
So we've talked a little bit about this, especially around the declining enrollment recommendation. But there was some question if the October student count really is the best time to be taking account to understand the true number of students a district has to be serving. And so we heard that there's gatherings and end-of-seasonal work and receipt of permanent fund dividends that change behaviors in communities, and so October might not be the time when it really is that has to be the high point, but that's the best estimation of the students that district will serve throughout the year. That student count information, we didn't have that for the multiple data points, so we weren't able to look at that flow, but it's something that we think should be examined, and it goes back to the question of getting some funding stability to districts so they feel very comfortable that at least that October count is the right count for them.
Representative Pruitt, sir.
So when should we do the count then?
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what without the data, it's hard to review. There are more ways to count students across the country than if there are 50. There are 51, because you can include D.C. Every state counts them differently. And so they have average daily membership, where some states count every day. You have counts that look at the last half of the prior year and the first half of the current year. There are a lot of ways to do this. But what you're trying to make is a good estimation of the number of students a district's going to have to serve educationally over time. And if for some reason October in Alaska is not a good representation of what that count is, and that's what we are hearing that could be true, you'd want to look at that. October counts are very, very frequent across the country. I mean, it would be, you know, late September, early October is the time when many states run their counts either single day or two-week windows or whatever you're going to decide to do. What we're saying is it would be helpful to look at the flow data just to see if for some reason there's an odd blip in certain types of districts that really is lower than what they're sustaining throughout the rest of the year.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please continue.
Yeah, it almost seems like because if we do have the unique, and I highlighting the items here, they are unique challenges to Alaska. Mm-hmm. It almost seems like we would maintain some sort of reason why it would be a challenge at any point in time in the year if other states are doing it there at the beginning, because that's when you have the highest population of students, that's when they're going to be the most engaged. We just started school. You probably look at the springtime, and they're, you know, people have tapered off. You have kids that are tired of it. They're not showing up for whatever reason. They're sick. They're all the things. Then it almost seems like we're going to really struggle with finding a time. Mm-hmm. So is there a better way to come up with without adding additional costs and burdens to those districts, a general beyond just a 20-day snapshot, to be able to look at the total students? I mean, obviously, I'm not interested in placing a burden on a small district where they're having to report, you know, additionally. But are there other mechanisms in other states? Because it sounds like we will find, in this case, these challenges being existent, for those very same reasons, we're going to find challenges in other parts. And it looks like we may have to come up with something a little different.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's the piece we weren't able to look at. I mean, is it that there's a one-time blip, or is to your point, there are multiple, there's never a good time. You could look at ADM across the whole year. I mean, there's a number of ways you can do this. A lot of it comes down to what types of reporting systems you have, and we didn't dig into that. So if you talk about having a student count system that's really a push system where, you know, daily you're tracking and that data is going to the Department of Education, you know, those sort of data systems that are in place in some states and I just don't know here, you know, allow for data collection and analysis that could probably help to answer that question a little bit more quickly. But I think you made an excellent point. You don't want to put any system in place that provides additional burden on districts to track when there might not be, you know, kind of a, the marginal cost is higher than the marginal gain for anybody.
And Justin, could I ask for, again, a further clarification? I think Representative Pruitt, you know, further fleshed out your point, but in doing the study that you did, we, the state of Alaska, did not have the census information to give you to derive any real further analysis or recommendations from. So your recommendations are for us to begin by gathering the census data.
That's exactly correct, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Kittleman, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, as a follow-up to that, I guess I've kind of done some thinking but come up with no resolution. The October count allows us to have the most recent numbers before we enter our budget cycle. If we bring in counts from the previous year, a district may either have an increasing or declining population that could have a different effect but would not accurately reflect what's happening in the school for that year. And then we're already through our budget process by the time the school year ends, so it's kind of a difficult thing to adjust, and I didn't come up with a reasonable solution. The further back we go, the further away from the actual student population that we end up with as we're looking at our budget. So thank you.
Justin, that really summarizes that slide 47 was the end. You don't have another slide that says the end.
No. Yeah. Not have an end or a question slide.
But again, we emphasize that this is the first presentation of this report. It is now a public document. The document is available on the LBNA website for anyone that wants to look at this. We do have these folks on contract with us that will be able to do follow-up work through the LBNA committee, responding to questions or concerns as people get to digest this report. We have limited ability, basically your time costs us money, but we have limited ability to access these folks into the future here to further clarify, further explain, and have them help us and other legislators better understand and think about how we might implement some of these solutions. The role we have at LBNA here with this report is to be the conduit for our policy committees. That would particularly be the finance committees and their budget work and the standing committees on education considering what has been brought forward to us. With that, any further committee dialogue for our presenters of the APA report? Oh, you got off way too easy. Hearing, see, either you did a good job or we're just holding our fire. But thank you very much for good work. And I do want to say I appreciate, as I'm aware of how much our school districts helped you with this, and I will personally like to thank all the school districts who participated in the study. It is an imposition when we have people in there digging through their data and their statistics and taking their time. So to all those school districts, I thank them very, very much for their cooperation and assistance. And likewise, I really appreciate the efforts you really did in scoping this and doing your very best to get as much information and reflect all the diversity of opinions and experiences across the state into this report. It's another good germinal point for us to continue to view how we handle and address education funding, support, and accomplishing the objectives of education in our near future. And so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We've got two very small, short, concluding presentations here today, and there's been some confusion in the public about the role of LBNA with regard to two other studies that were underway, and the LBNA committee was charged in House Bill 278 with concluding the K-12 funding study that we just presented. But what I would like, there are two other studies underway. We've got a school design and construction report and a salary and benefits schedule for school district report. And I'd just like to have, first off, the EED and I think Elizabeth Newellman, there you are, just to give us and more than us, the public, a quick update on where you are on your school design and construction study. This is not to have the study presented. It's just to tell us how y'all are doing and when the public can expect to have this. Hi, welcome.
Thank you.
You can identify yourself for our record.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Elizabeth Noodleman, and I'm the Director of School Finance and Facilities for the Department of Education. And thank you, Chair, for inviting us here to give just a very brief update on the construction report. I'll just go over a couple items. I want to go ahead and go over the language in HB 278. Give folks a slight glimpse of the scope and the approach and the process of the report. Talk about the contractor who is undertaking the report and then just give you a progress update. So the report came to us in House Bill 278, which was passed into law in 2014 and included a Section 53, which had the requirement for the school design and construction report. And the language is short enough that I'll just go ahead and share that with everyone. The directive was, the Department of Education and Early Development shall prepare and submit a report to the legislature no later than June 15, 2015, on the benefits and disadvantages of using prototypical designs for school construction in both the rail belt and rural areas of the state. And so with that, the Department of Education went ahead and looked at creating a scope to put in an RFP to get that study underway. And the scope that was designed by the department, we wanted a multidisciplined team. So we looked to make sure that when we went out to look for a contractor, that contractor would use experts, engineers, energy experts, contractors, and building maintenance people, so that we weren't looking just for an academic review of publications. We wanted some boots on the ground in Alaska looking at our schools in different regions of the state. Our scope also directed the contractor to seek stakeholder input. That was important to us, that folks in Alaska that know about these buildings are part of the study. And the scope also asked the contractor, because the language said to look at construction in both the rail belt and other areas of the state, we wanted the contractor to have a breadth of examination of the state, and suggested they look at possibly 6 climate regions. So that was really the scope that the department put out there, and that RFP is at the State of Alaska website as a public document. So after going through the request for proposal and the procurement process, the contract was awarded to Envision Architecture and DeJong Richter. And they provided a proposal and took the charge to take on this project and bring the legislature back information. The contractor's methodology encompassed both a review of national publications and also surveying the school districts and breaking out the area into 6 regions and going out to those regions, which this has already been done. They went out to those regions and did some on-site school visits and also spoke to the folks in those regions at the schools and other stakeholders, parents, and students. And so they went out to 6 regions in the state, and they went to Barrow, Bethel, Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Kodiak, and Mat-Su. And that happened in approximately March of this year. The folks that did that were the contractors. It was Envision Architecture, an Anchorage firm, and DeJong Richter, some education planning folks. And they also had with them from multiple firms across Alaska. Some of these people were at the regional meetings. Some of them were developing surveys and doing research at their office. But part of the research team includes 5 engineers, 2 contractors, 1 project manager, and 1 building maintenance expert. And I just wanted to share that so people can understand the scope of Alaskans looking at Alaska's schools. We received our first draft from the contractor prior to June 15th, and we understand that the timeline, we did run out of time, and when we looked at that and the contractor wanted to flesh out some more research, the contractor wanted to take it back again to their expert research team, it became apparent that the right thing to do was to let the timeline go out a little bit further and have that project completed in accordance with the scope. At this time, we're expecting a final approximately September 1st of this year. So that's really the update that I have for you on the school construction project.
And thank you very kindly. Do we have questions for Ms. Noodleman? Representative Quito, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Ms. Noodleman. One of the questions I have, I guess you mentioned six regions for review, and you mentioned the major population centers of each of those areas. Did the contractor also consider or travel to any of the smaller communities in those regions?
Through the chair, Representative Quito, I don't have the exact areas that the contractors went to, but it's my understanding they did not get out to the smallest areas. And so the short answer would be they were in some of the more major areas and sought research from projects that this team had worked on previously and information from other sources to really flesh that out to include the smaller areas that they did not go out to in person.
Thank you. Senator McKinnon.
Mr. Noodleman, thank you for the update. One of the conversations that at least the Senate Finance Committee had regarding the contract was that if we place architects, engineers, and contractors as the team that reviews this, that each one of those can benefit from individual construction. And so I will read the report as it comes forward with that lens. So the concern is who is advocating to save the state money that is on the team, because the purpose was how do we evaluate whether individual design and individual considerations for each community is benefiting the state as far as the cost to place these items out there. As an example, we have a huge investment going into Kivalina, and that school in a different area would cost $18 million, and we're going to, well, we've allocated, I believe, $42 million, if I'm remembering the number correctly. And so that was the issue with evaluating the prototypical design and having an architect who benefits from individual design leading a team. So I just wonder if you can speak to that. But one way or another, that will be a lens that I have when I actually read the report, if it seems to be coming from a position that benefits each of those individuals who are participating, I may wonder where the state's representation was in that process.
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, I think the comments I would have towards that are, you know, the department relied on the charge, which was the disadvantages and benefits of prototypical study. And in our RFP, we queued up the contractors who would apply for that work with questions. And we had quite a few questions because as we looked at it, we didn't see the contractor bringing a solution to the legislature. We saw them bringing information to the legislature and specifically the benefits and disadvantages. So I would concur that there will be lenses to view the information. The department's goal was to get good information over a wide range of topics to be discussed.
Senator McKinnon, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So to follow up, then I'll be looking for mobilization and demobilization costs in the structure that is supporting individual design, as well as long-term maintenance consequences for individual systems that are individually set up that require the state to invest differently in each design. Does that make sense? So those will be at least two pieces of criteria that I'll use as lenses to look at whether they've actually fairly evaluated a prototypical school design.
Thank you.
Other questions? Hearing, seeing none, thank you. I do appreciate your time and patience with us this morning. Glad you stuck around for the previous presentation as well. Before we move on next to our last item on our business agenda today, I would note that Senator Gary Stevens has been with us for some time. I'm glad to have you. Welcome, sir. Our last status report update is on the evaluation of a salary and benefits schedule for school districts. And Diane, please come forward. With Diane Hirschberg, who is the, if I get it correct, the director of the UAA Center for Alaska Education Policy Research. And if you could introduce yourself and anyone else you would like to aid you on this. And again, we're looking for a high level. We're not looking for a report or preliminary report of how you are doing in the process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to introduce two people. One is behind me, Dr. Matt Berman, who is an economist from the Institute of Social and Economic Research. In case you actually have questions about methodology that have to do with the economic analyses, because I can't answer those, but he can. And also, I believe on the phone is Liz Brooks from the Department of Administration, and she was going to give the first part of, just to give you the background on how we came to do this study.
Okay, so Liz Brooks, are you available online?
I am.
Okay, you are very loud online. So. Very glad to have you here with us, and if you could please, again, we're looking for a brief summary of how you're doing on this project.
Yes, thank you. I'm Liz Brooks, and I'm a research analyst with the Department of Administration, and I work for the Director of Personnel and Labor Relations. And the Department of Administration was tasked to present a written proposal for a salary and benefits schedule for school districts, including an evaluation of and recommendations for teacher tenure. We sought a partnership with CAPER, Diane's organization at UAA, through a memorandum of understanding. And Diane has more information about the progress on the report.
So, I'm Diane Hirschberg, director of the UAA Center for Alaska Education Policy Research, and we are a little center within ICER, which I know you all are much more familiar with. So we'll jump right into the first thing, which is we are behind on our timeline. I'm almost relieved to hear that we're not the only ones. And really what happened was we ended up facing data challenges that we simply hadn't anticipated, and this has to do with the fact that we were using a lot of data that is gathered by a number of state agencies from a number of places, in particular in our schools, where simply there are missing values, there's inconsistencies. In some cases, there's you may be familiar with, sometimes there's census data that might list a community in one place when as a school in that community is in a district, not in the place that the census says it's in, and those kinds of things that just take time to clean and tease out. And in some cases, we couldn't tease these out until, in particular, Matt had done some initial analysis and said, wow, that's not right, gone back, found the data errors, reran it. So we have, as far as we can tell, resolved those issues. We have a draft report, and we've also been in very productive discussions with the Department of Administration and Department of Education, in particular with Commissioner Fisher, on not just what we have found with our analyses, but how better to present it than perhaps we as policy wonks who kind of get into our technical mindset tend to do. He's been incredibly helpful in feedback, and so what we're doing right now is tweaking some of the way we've presented the data so that it's going to make more sense when broader audience, including the legislature, is going through this report. The next steps, we're hoping next week, is actually to put this out for public comment. And the idea with public comment is not that we're revising the report based on feedback, but it's much more that we can compile for the Department of Administration to share with legislators and other policymakers responses to this report, in a sense much like what you just talked about with making the school finance report public and gathering comments. We will be doing that and providing that feedback along with the final prettied up version of the report. I am happy to go into more detail on the separate pieces of what we've been doing, and I'd like to ask your sense of whether you'd like me to do that. I am prepared to talk about the different pieces of the study, not findings, but just what we have done, what questions we're asking.
For that, when do you anticipate being concluded and actually delivering a final work product?
What we talked with the commissioner about is having a draft released hopefully next week, but we really want him to be fully comfortable that this is a product that he's ready to see out for public consumption. And then about a 2-week public comment period. And then we would provide, as I said, both the public comments as well as the final report. There may be in our report a couple of things that, for instance, superintendents, school business officers, the Department of Education sees that we missed. We've actually had a lot of very good feedback to date from the Department of Education, so we don't anticipate any major changes, but we just want to make sure that we are presenting as accurate a picture in terms of the data we give you as possible.
So the will of the committee here, would you like further discussion and discourse on the details of their report, or wait for a week here? I'm personally comfortable with the update on the status here, but certainly it's open to the committee. Senator Lyman?
You're the chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Senator. Again, so I think, you know, that was exactly what we needed, was the update on when we can expect to see this work, and appreciate your update on how you are going to be going a two-stage release in the report process. Senator McKinnon, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So no later than September 1st, we should see something?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure, yeah.
Thank you very kindly. We appreciate that. Okay, well, that brings us to the conclusion of our education business today, as always. Other committee business, does anyone have anything to bring up for the good of the committee? Senator McKinnon, ma'am.
Mr. Chairman, Medicaid is an issue that many people are passionate advocates for, and there are people who have contacted my office in opposition to the governor's process on his attempts to expand Medicare and accept those dollars. I'd like to make a request that within the next short time that we try to bring a committee meeting together to at least hear what is proposed under the executive order, and then have a an opportunity to vote on that issue.
Speaking as the chair of this committee, I did distribute to the entire legislature two legal opinions, both of which do document and conclude that no matter how this committee would recommend the governor proceed, we have no voice in his decision to implement the expanded Medicaid. He has, if we choose to, if we do not respond to his RPLs, he has 45 days from the days he issued them to wait, and then he can continue regardless of any action. If we have a hearing on those, and we have members of this committee vote one way or another on those RPLs, it will immediately trigger his ability to pursue his actions under those RPLs. The issue before this committee is the RPLs, and in the fact that the governor has stated very clearly, both publicly and to me personally, that he is not going to take the legislature's counsel into consideration. He has made a firm and final decision. There's frankly nothing of substance for this committee to accomplish. There are bills, policy bills, in our state policy committees, one in the Senate Finance Committee, at least one in, or like at least one, I think maybe two in Senate Finance, at least one, maybe two in House Finance. And those committees would be, in my opinion, the more appropriate venue to take up a policy discussion where there can be a substantive outcome. So it's something we'll certainly take under consideration, but this committee is not a policy committee by statute. This committee is not empowered to speak on policy decisions on behalf of the entire legislature, and I don't want to give any impression to the public that we have greater authority or responsibility than we in fact have in what our role is here, which is only in an advisory role to the governor on RPL requests. Again, we have no ability whatsoever at this committee to change the outcome that the governor has said he will in fact see through to the finish here. So, Senator Gieselman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Respectfully, as a separate yet equal branch of government, the opportunity to review the documents publicly is part of our responsibility and authority. And I would appreciate that opportunity in this committee, understanding that I understand that the statute authorizes the governor to act unilaterally. Nevertheless, it is our responsibility, and we are an equal, though separate, branch. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I appreciate your comment. Thank you. Senator McKinnon.
Mr. Chairman, in addition to Senator Giesel's comments, the process by which this is coming down is part of this committee's responsibility. It is our job to approve or at least comment on an appropriation issue, certainly of this magnitude. I believe the number is $146 million, $148 million. I did read the legal opinion this morning. The legal opinion does have a bit of ambiguity on the governor's ability to change the structure statutorily on expansion of an eligible group of recipients. But again, I respect the chairman in the role that the governor is allowed to proceed. But I do believe that having someone here to explain his executive order and our ability to ask questions, as well as deny or reduce the appropriation amount that he is placing fiscally as a responsibility for the state, is in the purview of this committee. So I respectfully request scheduling the governor's executive order.
And I will take your request under advisement. The entire legislature has already voted. The entire legislature, the House and the Senate, have voted to tell the governor we do not want him to do this. We have the entire legislature on record. That was done very clearly in the budgets that we passed in the the legislative process during the legislative session. That is the appropriate vehicle for the legislature to express itself, not one or two people on this committee to attempt to create the appearance that we are speaking on behalf of the entire legislature. But I'll certainly take your requests under advisement, and we will see where we go with this. Further questions or concerns? Well, with that, we'll stand this committee in adjournment.